and welcome to the Hear It podcast. I'm your host, Rebecca Roberts, and I'll be speaking with guests on their campaigns, insights and ideas to better engage youth audiences. I really hope you like it. This episode, we're speaking with Penny Norman, Strategy Director at Rescue, the behaviour change agency working with governments and nonprofits to tackle behavioural health campaigns in the US, specifically nicotine, cannabis and opioids. Penny, thanks very much for coming on the podcast today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So tell us a little bit more about your work at Rescue and how you ended up there and your approach to influencing youth audience when it comes to behaviour change.
Yeah, absolutely. So I suppose I should probably go back to why Rescue was established, which is absolutely core to youth and behaviour change. Jeff Jordan, our founder, was an 18-year-old being paid to be at an anti-smoking event, and he was handing out T-shirts. And he looked around and he was like, none of these kids would ever smoke. None of my friends would be at this event who are all smoking. Like, you know, this is just preaching to the converted. What are they doing here? And he sort of enraged him enough to set up Rescue, where he specifically focused on understanding teens who genuinely were at risk of starting to smoke and their health impacts. He then developed this approach called social branding, where he really stopped looking at teens as this homogenous group and started to really understand that there's sort of tribes within teens. And they all define themselves differently. What he was seeing in public health was that public health would be like, oh, well, we'll just have a shot with like a mix of teens and be like, don't smoke. No teen was seeing themselves in that. And very often they would do sort of smart looking teens. They would focus on teens who achieved a lot to be like, I don't smoke. And none of that really got to the heart of teens who many of them might be, you know, really struggling, and their choice to smoke was often counterculture. And so he developed social branding to really understand the different tribes and what drives smoking habits. So for instance, one tribe is country teens. Now in the US, which is a bit different from the UK, the US country teens, very traditionally based, very much focus on what their parents do. If their parents smoke, they will absolutely smoke. Very family orientated. And understanding those drivers and what values they had, you then positioning your messaging in a very different way. So for them, we actually go and talk to them about anti-smoking in the lens of protecting their younger siblings and saying, I know that if I smoke, my younger brother will probably smoke and I want to protect his lung. Go to a different group, say the alt teens who are smoking to rebel. And so then that's a suddenly different one. And in fact, the alt teens often, they'll see smoking as a sort of rite of passage to join their group. It's how they define themselves as a group. Like, oh, we all smoke. So almost to join their group, you have to smoke. So then it's like understanding the values around that and understanding, like giving them permission to be like, I can be an alt teen and also not smoke, and really changing the sort of social construct around that, the social norms as well. What we talk about. So super interesting approach, and it started in nicotine and worked with a number of states, then worked with the FDA and did a campaign across the US, so huge pieces. But also as we were working on nicotine, other issues came up for teens that were really prominent, and also other high-risk groups. And we started to work on cannabis a lot, opioids. We also do a lot of healthy eating, promoting healthy eating and healthy behaviors in that sense as well. So yeah, so it really grew from that kind of core. At Rescue, I am a strategy director. So I do all the upfront thinking, and I specifically focus on substances. So my big work is focused on cannabis usage within teens and opioid usage, specifically the fentanyl crisis, because we're seeing now nearly over 1,000 teens a year dying of fentanyl overdoses, which is incredibly sad. And that's actually up like 94%. In 2 years. So there's this huge spike in deaths. And so really understanding the drivers of usage, giving teens the information around what's going on with fentanyl.
And so what's your background? Like, how did you wind up at Rescue? Have you always done behaviour change? Yeah, and I know you're sort of a Brit abroad.
I am. So I myself am based in Vancouver, BC, but I spent the first 7 years of my career in London at big ad agencies. And I was actually client side, but I was sort of the mini planner on the client side. So very strategic client side person. So I was an account director at Publicis and then Abbott Mead Vickers, influenced by a big planning group. And I think the thing that really got under the skin for behavior change for me was working on the NHS blood and organ donor campaign with the fantastic planners there, specifically led by Bridget Agnew, who's unbelievably amazing. And we pitched for that work on an incredible insight around, instead of asking people to give their organs, which is what everyone does, like it researched really well, people loved it, but they just wouldn't do it. And then Bridget came up with this incredible insight around, well, 93% of people would take an organ, why wouldn't you be on the organ donor register? And just by the fact of saying that, and the central like value of British people being very focused on fairness and, you know, reciprocity being the center of that, just by putting that out there, I was sitting in research groups and just, it actually gave me chills because these people, we'd researched all the other routes, none of it worked. And we researched this one and they went, I have to go and sign up now. Like, I have to. And we followed up with them and all of them had. And we were like, we're onto something. So we pitched it, we won it with incredible clients. And then we ran the campaign and we got 1 million people to sign up to the Organ and Register in 3 months, which has never been seen before. I was obsessed with that. I loved that campaign and just loved the impact of it. And then I moved to Canada and I continued to do corporate stuff. And then I moved in specifically into strategy after about 2 years in Canada as a head of department for a small sort of startup. We grew that to quite a big piece. And through that, like being the head of strategy there, I picked up a few more social impact campaigns, including working with UBC on men's mental health and creating a website and campaigns for them. And then also YWCA around policy work around the $10 a day childcare. Big thing in Quebec where you pay $10 a day for childcare and they wanted to bring it to BC. And I helped them position that in a fresh way. And it worked. It got adopted into Parliament. It's now happening, which is amazing. So seeing these different facets of behaviour change. And so when I felt it was time to move on, I found Rescue.
There are these big issues in society and almost like, I guess it's just our nature as marketeers made to kind of go, well, let's reinvent the wheel and do something totally different. And those learnings are often lost, right? And we see it in politics mm-hmm. all the time, like something will work. New government, like PM's here, like it's a weekly thing at the moment, but you know, someone will come along and say, let's do this and let's not do that. At Rescue, it's quite different because you license these campaigns, right? And you kind of take the approach that, but you have that learning and you can kind of share that across all these people that kind of want to create that bigger change.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, so with organ donation, we had this incredible strategy that worked and had not been done before and was being quite, like, we won every effectiveness award. And I'm like, we solved it. Everyone in the world will be doing this strategy. And no one did. I've seen it a few times, actually. I was like, why didn't they do it? Like, what? This makes no sense. And it drives me mad. And it's that whole sense of like, we want to do something new and innovative and that drive. And in fact, with public health and really important issues, you actually need to be constantly building on your knowledge and constantly optimizing. So at Rescue, we do both. We do licensing. So we have central, almost products that buy into them. You get the brand, the assets. But what we do is regular research in your state as well to understand what's going on. And then every state that contributes and every research project adds to the collective knowledge of that product. And we continue to update it and evolve it. So that product probably started 10 years ago. Now, obviously, there's different platforms. There's a much higher level of mental health issues with teens. So you obviously need those products to evolve, et cetera. But this idea of an additive approach. And we also do bespoke, but because at Rescue, we have multiple clients that focus on the same cannabis challenges, multiple clients that are focused on the fentanyl crisis, we are very additive with that. So I have tons of learning from Illinois. I'll take those, I'll test them in Washington and see if that's working. I'll learn something new from Washington, I'll bring that back to Illinois. Oh, and we need to do something in San Diego. What would cross? Let's test those. So we're always adding and building. And Rescue, we always focus on people becoming kind of subject matter experts in that sense, because and we do diversify to a degree, but becoming a subject matter expert really allows you to constantly be building and making sure we're building on knowledge and known things. We're never starting from zero with any of our clients, which is really awesome.
And that's great. And how much flexibility do you offer that? Because you mentioned messaging sort of suite, media packs. I guess that adaptability can be quicker because you're not starting, like you say, from zero.
Yeah, I mean, we have a set of assets for the licensable products. We'll often build fresh for the clients who mainly come to us for our like bank of knowledge, and they'll sometimes want new things, especially because the US is so diverse. And also even seeing what media works and how we use the latest platforms that teens are on to really make sure the work is where they are.
So what things do you think you need to get right when it comes to building a behavior change campaign for young people? You mentioned subcultures there, which is really interesting, and that kind of context and where people are at in terms of if they're an addict or the reasons they might be turning to these substances.
Where we really start is understanding the drivers of usage. So very often with youth, and we're seeing it very starkly in the US, this mental health crisis, which everyone is talking about, that is really driving a lot of substance use. And the other thing we also start with is that teens are in this incredibly transformative stage of their life. So like their brains are developing hugely, and they also have like an absolute need to bond with others. So these are the two big drivers. And I say absolute need. In fact, if they don't move away from from their parental influence and bond with their peers, they actually become more miserable adults. It's actually needed to be a healthy adult. It's awful for parents. It's so sad. It's really important that they do that. So there's two big drivers. There's this absolute chronic need to bond and be with their peers and impress others and form those bonds away from the family. And then you also have this mental health crisis, which is driven by a number of factors. We're seeing school stress peak hugely. We're seeing influences from being on social media, and we're seeing obviously like social context. That's everything from Black Lives Matter movement and all of the racism we're seeing through to climate change, who's in government, Roe and Wade, like all of those factors, and like just really sensing the dumpster fire, as everyone calls it, that is happening. And I think this generation is so connected to the news, is so connected globally. They have so much more access. I mean, when we grew up, like, yeah, there was newspapers, but did you read a newspaper? But nowadays, teens are savvy. They know stuff. They're seeing the feeds coming in. And then obviously with the pandemic, I should not mention the pandemic, that hugely impacted teens. They couldn't bond. Is terrible for them. And they also, they felt like they were a missed generation. They missed out. And that's a horrible feeling, to feel like, oh my God, I'm missing out. But it is an insight we actually use with cannabis quite a bit. So really understanding the drivers of that substance use is fundamental, because then you start to be like, okay, so this is what's driving it. And then we lean into like being completely empathetic. The worst campaigns have this like judgmental level. There's a very famous campaign called Stoner Sloth in the US that is the worst thing. And it's very aggressively anti, like, don't be this stoner sloth, like you're not yourself on weed. But the way they portray it is absolutely lacks any empathy for what that teen is going through. Because very likely if they're using cannabis, they are using that, and a lot of cannabis, they're using that to basically medicate themselves to just get to school. And yet this spot ridicules this teen who's come to school despite feeling terrible. He's dragged himself there, and they ridicule him for using cannabis. And you're like, hang on a minute, he's at school. Like, can we just understand that that's probably the huge effort for him to get there? Leading with empathy, really understanding what's going on in their lives, and then building from there. We use a framework, I recommend you go onto the Rescue YouTube channel. We talk about decision blocks. There's a new webinar coming up, going to be January, talking about, we have certain frameworks, we're always looking to evolve and improve them. And we've got our latest version of decision blocks coming out in January. And so that's going to be really how we start to look at the different layers of behavior change. And decision blocks specifically we use for substances where it's kind of universal, whereas nicotine, it's such an evolved behavior. We use more of that sort of segmentation approach where we really understand the subgroups. With cannabis being so universal, we start to look at it more as a big group, but understanding the key drivers. And we have sort of four layers to that. Are they missing foundational knowledge? Is there a gap there that we need to fill? And is that enough? And then relevance, what's blocking them being like, oh, this affects me? Because often people have the information. They're like, oh, but I'm good. I have a friend who smokes every day. I am not him. And so really breaking through that otherization. And then there's this action piece of like, what is an achievable action? Because very often we're like, hey, just completely stop. I mean, that's not achievable if you're using it to just survive or not get angry, which is very common. And then the last one is maintenance, which is all about like, how do you continue to support that behavior change?
You take that approach to kind of build the messaging and everything from like what's actually needed by different groups as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So the first thing we start with is really understanding what layer would be most useful. So for instance, with healthy eating, especially with parents, parents know that they should be feeding their kids greens and apples. It's just really hard to do. Like their local shop may not even stock fresh produce. So that really is at the top level of like facilitation, like just give them really clear directions on what they can do within the confines they have. They already have the knowledge. They already know they should be doing it. There's so much mum guilt around that. So then they're at the top end. Whereas with cannabis or fentanyl, which is newer places, you really have to start at the bottom. With fentanyl, like the big knowledge gap is that they all believe their source of drugs is safe. Most of their source of drugs is their friends. They always go, I heard about fentanyl, but my guy has the good stuff. Or, but it's my brother's best friend who gives me the drugs and he would never do that. But what they don't realize is that those drugs, those press pills, change hands over 10 times before it reaches them. At any point, they could be laced with fentanyl. And when the DEA seizes bunches of pills, 2 in 5 have a deadly dose of fentanyl. It is like Russian roulette completely about like them taking it. So filling that gap of questioning their source is so huge. So that's a really big one that we focus on.
And what I really liked when we were chatting the other day about that understanding those subgroups is that you actually speak to them. So you actually speak to users, you try and understand that without judgment. If you ask a sort of self-selecting group of young people to come forward, they're not going to be just like your founder found. Like, they're not going to be the ones that are going to be affected. So you kind of have to work hard to actually find the right people to get that information from.
So everything we do starts with research. Every group is different, but also it's just important that we understand the confines and that we're not unrealistic of what we can ask people to do. We have a full research team. They're like my favorite people in the world. I love working with them. It's really important we speak with the right people. So we will recruit specifically people who are using drugs in a certain way. I mean, I work with them. We've recruited people who've been using heroin for 10 years. That's about probably as extreme as it gets, but understanding how you recruit these people. And that's everything from having a really powerful network of recruitment partners, but also even like you find one person who's right, like seeing if they have a friend, like using the network effect, using even our contacts, like anything you can to get to the right people. Because if we research with the wrong people, if you get into that group, you're not going to get what you need. Yeah, spending a lot of time on recruitment and making sure you're speaking to the group that's highest risk of this behavior is really key.
A common mistake with behavior change campaigns developed by older people, I suppose, is there's a lot of telling. Like I joked around last time, it's like the grandchild just say no kind of movement in the UK in like 80s. But with cannabis and opioid campaigns, how do you avoid sounding like you're being the parent and sort of telling them to stop?
Really, our recommendation on a lot of the fentanyl work is don't do prevention necessarily. Acknowledge that drugs are used. Drugs have been used for eternity. We forget that alcohol is a drug. We forget that caffeine is a drug. But it is very normalized. And just because it's a pill, it sometimes is completely demonized. And it's a very stigmatized piece. So our most progressive clients, we actually only talk harm reduction. So that is ways to stay safe while you use drugs, even with a teen group, which is probably the coal phase of being very forward. And our clients at King County in Washington are amazing. They work every day with these teen groups who are high risk. Check out lacedandlethal.com if you want to have a look at some of the work. But obviously, some states are just not there, and we have to focus on prevention. And there is always that double-headed sword. If you talk about harm reduction, is that encouraging usage? And it really doesn't. There's no science that connects that at all. Prevention is an easier way for states that have a sort of, you know, we want to reach a bigger group. We want to make sure that they understand the risks if they are being offered. And the reality is that 20% of students in the US, high school students in the US, have been offered pills in the school environment. And if you think, again, back to that, 2 in 5 of those press pills will probably have a deadly dose of fentanyl. It's a really scary fact. So even talking to teens about that moment of being offered and giving them some key information to understand this risk. And there's just this big knowledge gap of like, you know, in the moment, they're like, oh, it's cool. This cool guy's offered me this. I should do it. In that moment, they're not thinking, oh, the public health officials just had this big fentanyl will kill you. I should probably think about that. They will do stuff partying. They're, you know, they may be a bit drunk. You know, they'll do stuff that they, you know, they can look back and they're like, oh my God. And the worst thing is, and I feel really sorry for teens right now, like when we grew up, we all did stupid things. Like, of course, your experimentation is, you need to experiment. You need to push the boundaries as a teen. And right now, unfortunately, that can have deadly consequences like it never has before. And it's a really understanding that moment of decision making and trying to disrupt that. So we do a lot of work like within bars and clubs for young adults. Within teens, it's like understanding like, how do we disrupt that moment? And we actually like try and feature the moment as well and just get them to like have pre-lived someone offering and what they would think. But we do talk about the balance of prevention and harm reduction and where we go with that. And some of that's targeting for the highest risk teens. We really go harm reduction, prevention for the lower risk teens, but it's really making sure you understand like the balance of where that plays.
And then we mentioned channels before. So how do you approach developing a channel strategy for these campaigns coupled with meaningful metrics? So we know the reality is a young person isn't, even no matter how great the campaign, go, that's great, I'm going to share that and I'm going to follow that account. Like, it's just different, isn't it, with kind of health campaigns?
Absolutely. And I think taking a hard look at your metrics, I think it's really easy to be like, hey, we want everyone to follow our page. And you're like, I am talking about something that is not aspirational. So I think taking a hard look at that, you know, we break it into exposure of message So that's really where you have to start. And it's really boring because it's like impressions, and impressions don't mean anything. But then we have interaction. So you have this sense of where they're starting to play around with that message. They've responded in some way. You can tell that they've swiped in relation to your message, which is a sign that they've really taken it in. But then we talk about like really immersion of that message and really engaging with it formally. So there's sort of those are the big three buckets that we talk about with a brand new topic. Sometimes, you know, impressions are, you know, you lean more to that top end. But as we're sort of seeing, so for instance, with fentanyl, we're seeing people having a better understanding of fentanyl. We now really want them to sort of start connecting it to them and themselves and their own scenarios. So one of the things we did, and this was for young adults versus teens, so 18 to 35, we started putting more of a framework around what we want people to do. So one of the insights we found was it's really hard to get young people to say, I'm in danger. They're just very invincible mindseted. And I'm sure everyone finds that within their research. And when you look at all the ads, they always say, you could be at risk. You. And we actually flipped that on the head because we found this interesting insight that most people believe their friends do more drugs than them. And most people believe their friends do high risk drugs. And there's a little bit of chat about that. You know, like people be like, oh, I got so smashed. And obviously it's easier to look at someone else's behavior than your own. But of note, their behavior is often very reflective of what their friends are doing. But their perception is that they do more. And so we actually tested a line around, instead of talking about harm reduction in the lens of protect yourself, we actually talked about it about protect your friends. To totally flip the focus. So we weren't saying, you've got to analyze your drug usage, you've got to blah, 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 blah. It's actually like, hey, you know, this thing is going on. Here are all the ways you can protect your friends. So the other thing we did for this young adult group was actually build a bit of a framework around how they could act. So using that insight of protect your friends, we created a little quiz, which was three quick questions of what do their friends use, which drugs they're using, where they're using, and how often. And based on that, we did these sort of tailored tips. And what we were able to do is, first and foremost, what we found is that that quiz prompted it three times more people to find naloxone, which is what reverses overdoses, and they can carry it, which is awesome. So it worked from a behavior change perspective. But also what's interesting is that I can now have live data from my campaigns around what is going on from a usage perspective. So I can see if certain drugs are being more popular. Like we started seeing Adderall being used more. We're seeing fentanyl in Adderall now, counterfeit Adderall, watching that. Do I need a campaign based on Adderall now? Do I need it more on cocaine? And also what most interesting thing for me on that data was that when we looked at where people, their friends were using, the majority were using alone. The most dangerous time to use because there's no one there to say, if you overdose. So that made me see that we need, in our next round of research, we need to hyper focus on people who use alone and trying to mitigate, get them to understand the risk and then give them ways to reduce their risk. I would only get that from that live data, which is really interesting.
And you mentioned channel strategy. So, you know, I guess it's just a constant check on what works. I know that when we did the sexual health stuff, Snapchat, some ads worked, some were kind of kicked off. TikTok liked them for ages, then didn't like them, then we just rebooted it and it worked fine. So I think with health stuff, I guess you kind of have the same challenge. You found this whole situation, like how easy it was, these fake accounts set up on Instagram to actually get access to drugs.
This is why it's like almost heartbreaking, but the platforms, the way they're set up is that they're ripe for promoting drug usage. TikTok is known for having like a very positive narrative about drugs. HITOC was like had 3 million followers. And even now they shut down HITOC. They now, what they use is just emojis for people to find the content around that. And then once you look at that, the algorithm shows you more content like that. TikTok's one thing. And they're really hard to get a prevention message up there or harm reduction message up there. Instagram's the other one. So there's this really fascinating study where they set up some teen accounts. So they put their age as a teenager. They didn't have many pictures. They just pretended to be teenagers and they went on and they found that they could find a drug dealer within 2 clicks and purchase drugs. It takes 5 clicks to log off of Instagram, to just give you a context there. And then once they'd seen the drug dealer's page, the algorithm promoted other drug dealers to them, suggested accounts, just further fueling this. And this is for underage, a teen group. So absolutely terrifying. We do work very closely with Meta in an approval process. A lot of our work is constantly taken down because it's the platform will also look at our work. And sometimes we get it through, sometimes we don't. It's a really hit and miss. We often will spend about 2 weeks trying to get stuff live. We'll tweak it. We'll take out a word here. We'll see if we can get it there. So with Meta, we actually go through a process called getting legit script approved, which is where they flag you as someone in public health
doing good things. So then you don't have the same approval process and you can get things through, which we just got one of our accounts. We had a whole happy dance because we were like, oh my goodness, because they were just pulling everything down.
I'd say that's like the holy grail of getting it sorted, right? I think lots of people listening who do the public health side of things would just be like, yeah, that's what we need. Because if you can have those relationships with TikTok or whoever, I would say definitely if you're going to do on TikTok, get an account manager.
It's interesting. The other thing that comes up with social media is like the comments you get. So you can imagine my work, like we get a lot of comments, but it's funny because actually it's really, we actually sort of embrace them, whether it's a little bit of trolling or people being like, you just don't do drugs. But actually what's interesting is sometimes people who like comment negatively about our campaign, those are exactly the group we want to reach. And it's actually a sign that they saw it. And that's really important for us. So we actually see it as like, oh, that's great. They saw it. And it gives us also an opportunity to respond to them. So we see a negative comment as great because then we can go back to them and say, hey, did you think about it that way? Or that's actually a really common misconception, actually X, Y, and Z. And that allows us to address like someone who's high risk and rejecting that message. But also even if someone is stigmatized, it lets to live address stigma, which I'm always up for. So I would say embrace those comments.
So what do you think are the fundamental things to try and include or get right if you're developing a campaign to engaging people? Research-wise, channels, messaging, like are there like a few top basic tips you'd share?
One of the insights we just got from a recent teen study was that they don't click on websites. It's a part of me like what's so sad because I was like, oh. So I think really think through what you can do in platform. And so TikTok has some great like instant experiences, polls, like understand that that can be enough and not have this web destination as necessarily an important goal for teens. Understand that you can actually engage with them in platform, engage them in conversation. So think through that, I would say is a great tip. As far as messaging, yeah, as I said, like deep empathy. They are having a really tough teen time. Not only just we all had a tough time, teen time, but on top of that, there's so many more stresses and levels that they're going through. So leading with empathy, really talk to them and understand what's driving the behavior. And then I would also say empower them to make the right decision. Don't tell them what to do. So we do that a lot with cannabis. Instead of saying, don't use cannabis, we just say, learn the facts of cannabis. And we actually talk about being pro-brain, not anti-cannabis. So we actually just focus on your brain is amazing. It's growing, like it's doing amazing things, but cannabis has this impact on it. You make the decision, but we just want to give them the information for them to make an informed decision. Now that decision could be still to use, but they have the information and they're not in the dark on that. So that's like stage one for us. So think about empowering them to make the right decision, not telling them what to do.
Are there any campaigns that you think do a really good job at engaging kind of younger audiences?
There was one that came up recently and we had a big debate internally. I loved it. It was for fentanyl and it's done in New York and we always keep an eye on it. And what they did was they brought drug dealers into a school to talk to the teens about how drugs are funneled through multiple cartels, how fentanyl gets in it, how it's cut, how it's laced, why they do it. And it's all ex, obviously, drug dealers, not real ones. So these were ex drug dealers. It was just such a powerful person to talk to teens about it. And they also did that with teens that were high risk. So like even the teens featured were like, they weren't like popular teens necessarily, or these they weren't like, straight laced teens in any way. It was a true school environment. It was real people and the authenticity of that message. And again, just hearing it from someone that teens, you know, would see as legitimate voice was so important. The one debate we had was this time length. The video is 2 minutes and that's probably too long for a teen to watch. I'm sure they did cut down.
Thank you so much for coming on today. It's been really great chatting to you.
So great to talk about all of this. So thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Hear It podcast. If you like what you heard, please rate, review and subscribe as it really helps others find us. You can also follow us on Twitter @Hear It Podcast or drop us a message by emailing info@threadandfable.com.